In this time, when the days are short and the sun is bright and clear, in this time, when the nights are long and the stars and planets sparkle, we come together, a gallery of friends and strangers, joined in the common purpose of Unitarian Universalism. Welcome to this place where we see your dignity and worth. Welcome to this place where we acknowledge our interdependence. Welcome to First Unitarian Church of Albuquerque. I'm Reverend Bob LaValle, and I'm delighted to be joined by our senior minister, Reverend Angela Herrera, and our music director, Susan Peck. Our worship leader today is Casey Spivey, and our DJ today is Tech Arts Director, Chris Paul. Our tech volunteers are Dan Small, Cy Schuster, Raymond Wolfgang, and Bill Miller. And want to say thanks for all that you do, tech team. All right, Casey has an announcement or two.
Thank you, Bob. Yes, two announcements. This year, we're consolidating our Christmas Eve gatherings into one all ages service with an online Las Posadas, fabulous traditional music, and a homily by Angela Herrera. Join us on Thursday at 6 p.m. and bring the whole family. You can find the Zoom link on our website and in our weekly broadsheet. Note, there will be no Vespers this Wednesday. No Vespers this Wednesday. Second announcement, holidays can be a particularly challenging time for those affected by addiction. Please join the Addiction Recovery Ministry immediately following today's church service. Thank you.
Our chalice lighting draws on the words of Reverend Scott Taylor. When our days turn cold and the light dims, may we take hold of the hands reaching out and let them lead us to the comforting flame. When repression and indignity rise, may we kindle the lamp of justice together. When exhaustion seeps into our bones, may we let the soft light lead us to rest. And when joy sneaks in and surprises us with grace, may we stop for just one sacred moment and celebrate. Come, let us worship together.
Jingle all the way. Oh. our affirmation. We are Unitarian Universalists. We are people of faith with open minds, loving hearts, and helping hands.
Good morning. I'm Mia Noren, the Director of Religious Education here at First Unitarian Church of Albuquerque. What is a solstice? The word solstice comes from the Latin words sol, meaning sun, and sistere, to stand still, because the sun's movement across the sky appears to pause and be still in its path before winter begins and the sun's path reverses. A solstice is an astronomical event that happens twice a year, once in summer and once in winter. The winter solstice is the shortest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. This year, it's on Monday, December 21st. Our Unitarian Universalist sources encourage us to embrace science as well as the spiritual teachings of Earth-centered traditions, so we mark the winter solstice and teach about it. We have focused on science and the modern pagan observance of winter solstice, but our sources also tell us to draw from the wisdom of all the world's religions. The winter solstice has been celebrated in cultures around the world for thousands of years. And today, I'd like to share just a few stories and celebrations with you that you might not be familiar with. Before humans understood the solar system and how gravity sends us around the sun on our round and slightly tilted planet, people told stories to explain the darkness, entertain or frighten each other, or to keep spirits up and provide reassurance. Today, our ancient stories and practices from around the world help tie us to the earth and the wonder and mystery of nature and to our ancestors. In Native American cultures, there are as many religious ceremonies and community events associated with the winter solstice as there are tribes. Locally, the Zuni Pueblo holds a multi-day celebration at this time called the Shalako Festival. This festival is not for public viewing, except for one ceremony near the end of the celebration. Six Zuni men dress to embody the spirit of giant bird deities and carry Zuni prayers for rain to all corners of the earth. The Zuni believe their ceremonies are necessary not just for the well-being of the tribe, but for the entire world, demonstrating an ancient understanding of the interconnectedness of all existence. In Greece and the surrounding countries of Southeastern Europe, there are many stories of the Kalokantzaros, angry, hairy little goblins who lived underground and try to cut down the tree of life. They can be killed only with sunlight, and so would emerge during the solstice to try to wreak havoc on homes and villages. However, they were also rather dumb and unable to count past two, so villagers put colanders out on their doorsteps, and the Kalokantzaros would end up trying to count the holes in the colanders until sunrise before rushing back underground to avoid the deadly sun. The sun is vital in the Arctic regions, where it disappears for 40 or more days. People in the Sami culture live in northern Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. The Sami are an indigenous Arctic people, and their goddess, Bavi, represents the sun. Reindeer are at the center of this ancient culture, and a reindeer would be sacrificed to the goddess at winter solstice. Bavi would then travel through the sky in a construction made of reindeer antlers, bringing spring with her. Not only did she ensure the return of the greenery that both reindeer and Sami people relied on, but she was also able to restore mental health. The Sami believed depression and psychosis were provoked by a lack of sunlight. In Finland, mythology tells of Louhi, an evil witch queen or goddess of the north who kidnapped the sun and moon and held them captive inside a mountain, causing the long darkness of winter. The East Asian festival of Dongzi is a winter solstice festival celebrated in China, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. The Chinese identified the shortest day of the year about 2,500 years ago, and the Dongzi festival started sometime during the Han Dynasty, about 500 years later. While not celebrated as grandly now as it was in the past, it's still a traditional time for family gatherings, and many families eat colorful Tang Yuan rice balls or lamb dumplings as part of the celebration. On the longest night of the year, Iranians all over the world celebrate the victory of Mithra, the sun god, over darkness in the ancient festival Shabi Yalda. This celebration originates with Zoroastrianism, which predates Islam. Yalda night, the longest and darkest night of the year, is a time when friends and family gather to eat fruits and nuts, drink, and read poetry, sometimes all night, until it can be confirmed that the sun has risen again. Pomegranates and watermelons are an important part of the festivities. The red color in these fruits symbolizes the crimson hues of dawn and the glow of life. Shabi Yalda was officially added to Iran's list of national treasures in a special ceremony in 2008. The winter solstice in the Southern Hemisphere falls on June 20th and 21st. Many African solstice celebrations have disappeared or been assimilated into other holidays, but we know that some ancient African cultures made complex astronomical observations and mathematical calculations to estimate agricultural cycles. Modern eyes have seen ancient structures left by cultures throughout Africa that are similar to the complex calendar structures of other ancient cultures around the world, including 7,000-year-old Nabta Playa in Ethiopia. There is no reason to believe that these builders did not also have traditional ceremonies and rituals related to solstice. I hope you've enjoyed learning more about solstice traditions around the world. There are many, many more than I have told you about today. See what you can find. Try exploring what your family's origin cultures might have believed and celebrated.
That was so interesting. The solstice truly has such spiritual meaning and power and just transcends all the cultures. Tomorrow's winter solstice also coincides with a very unusual event in the sky, which is that the planets Jupiter and Saturn, which have also been orbiting the sun, are going to line up with Earth's orbit. And for about an hour, they will be so close together that if you look through a telescope, for about an hour visibly, they'll be so close together that if you look through a telescope, you'll be able to see both planets in the same frame. And looking without a telescope, they will appear to be extraordinarily bright stars. And they might even look like one big star. This moment is called the Great Conjunction. And some are calling it an early Christmas star. You can see it by going outside about 45 minutes after the sun sets and looking out at the western horizon where the sun has just gone down. Just looking along that horizon, you'll find them. Now they're going to be closest together tomorrow when they're all lined up, but you can see them tonight and the day after tomorrow as well. It's amazing to think of all the light, all the energy out there around us in space, extending as far as we can imagine and farther. And to think that we are also on a planet, which also reflects the sun's light like the other planets and looks like a star. We have this place in the order of things, in the great turning and in all the movement. Let's turn off the chat for a few minutes now for the meditation, and then we'll turn it off later for the prayer as well. And let's focus our attention on the most personal of cycles, the breath. most intimate to us. In breath and out breath. Inhalation, energy coursing through you, cell energy, life energy, kinetic energy, love energy. Exhalation, you release. Notice also the rest at the end of your out breath. A pause. There's a time for everything, for expanding, energizing, acting, for releasing, resting, and entrusting. A time for being apart, and a time for convergence. Inhalation, exhalation. Attuning mindfully to this flow and honoring it, we're able to bring our whole selves in this world and to be whole selves with love and with our power. We continue with 2 minutes of silence.
We stand on the cusp of winter, knowing the flow of joys and concerns through our days and our nights. May our covenant spirit warm us and be tensile strength for us. We invite you to list now your joys and concerns in the chat bar. If you are unable to post in this area, please call the church office or email caring@uuabq.org. We wish to know how life may be unfolding for you and how we may support you. Please now follow the prompt on your screen as we begin the sharing of our joys first and then our concerns. Thank you.
all these loved ones and all these prayers we lift up to the great powers of healing, renewal, and celebration that we call by many names. I want to also lift up and name the news that Deb Holland, a 35th generation New Mexican, a member of the Pueblo of Laguna, and also someone with Jemez Pueblo heritage, has been nominated as Secretary of the Interior. It is huge news. The Department of the Interior has been responsible for the displacement and abuse of Indigenous people in this country from coast to coast. And if confirmed, Deb Holland's appointment to lead that department now would be a form of reparation. And I celebrate that and pray that it opens the door to many more kinds of reparation. And from this week's pastoral prayer list, we lift up Teresa Watson, whose two longtime canine companions are both in their final days, one from old age, one from unexpected illness. Such a sad thing to lose them both at once. Let us hold Janelle Campbell in the light. Janelle, a longtime member, so beloved, entering hospice now. May she be surrounded with love. May she receive the tender care she needs. May she be comforted and at peace. And I lift up the name of Jennifer Simpson, not a UU, but a friend to many in our congregation, who died unexpectedly this week, a writer and a teacher. May her passing be in peace. May those who knew and loved her be comforted. Will you join me in prayer? Love that holds all, great power of healing and renewal, mystery, you who have countless names and who are also nameless, spirit of life. All these prayers and all these loved ones we lift up to you, knowing that you are everywhere, partial and entire. You are in each star and planet in the sky, and in each cell and molecule in our bodies. You are in the ashes and in the light. And in us, you wonder, rage, cry, and love. We lift up our loved ones and we call ourselves into your presence, because today we could use a little holding. There's every shade of experience among us this morning. We are grieving people and grateful people. We are hurting, coping, and healing. We are losing and finding ourselves. So we call upon the love that holds all, and we pray for ourselves, for our loved ones, for our neighbors, and for the world. May there be peace. May the spirit of the solstice and of the season bring gladness. And may our lives be for blessing. May it be so. Amen. Peace be with you.
And also with you. Will you join me in singing our interlude carol? This is from the Gray Hymnal, number 224, Let Christmas Come. I'll play through the melody once. The words are in the chat box. That looks like they moved down a little bit. You can scroll back up to there. Let Christmas come, its story told, when days are short and winds are cold. Let Christmas come, its lovely song, when evening's soon and night is long. Let Christmas come, its great star glow, on quiet city parks of snow. Let Christmas come, its table gleam, love born again, the truth of dream.
A reading. A letter from the monk and mystic Thomas Merton to the poet Czesław Miłosz. The only thing to be regretted without qualification is for one to adapt perfectly to modern society. Then they are indeed beyond hope. Hence, we should all be sick in some way. We should all feel near to despair in some sense, because this semi-despair is the normal form taken by hope in a time like ours. Hope without any sensible or tangible evidence on which to rest. Hope in spite of sickness that fills us. Hope married to a firm refusal to accept palliatives or anything that cheats hope, pretending to relieve apparent despair.
Today I'm going to talk about a couple of books from the Hebrew Bible, sometimes referred to as the Old Testament. And these are pretty obscure books, Kings 1 and Kings 2. And at the urging of a minister friend of mine who works as a labor organizer in Buffalo, I read the book Kings and Their Gods, A Pathology of Power, that was written by Daniel Berrigan. And Berrigan's book looks at these two obscure books, Kings 1 and 2, through a modern lens. And he finds a lot to talk about. So Kings 1 begins with the death of King David after a long, glorious reign, a lot of conquest, a lot of wealth building. And the two books move through the story of many kings in that period. So Solomon, Jeroboam, Ahab, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Judah, and more. And the books are based on historical events from about 965 BCE to about 567 BCE. So there's some basis in fact and plenty of yarn spinning and interpretation, interventions of an Old Testament God. And the books are actually pretty fascinating reads. I was shocked to find they're full of compelling stories of encounters between warring tribes and lots of family drama and colorful turns of phrase. At one point, a group of rebellious subjects come to Solomon and ask for his mercy. And they say that his father, Solomon's father, David, would have been merciful. And Solomon responds by saying, "My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Where my father loaded you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions." Yikes. Don't let anybody tell you that the Bible is boring. It's not. Now, there are a lot of stories over the course of Kings 1 and Kings 2, but the gist of them, the overwhelming arc, overarching arc, is that Israel becomes a wealthy and powerful country, controlling all the lands in the Near East and building huge temples and huge armies. And they do this by enslaving many people to build those huge temples and using their military might to extend their power and wealth. But it doesn't go well for Israel and though. By the end of the books, Israel is divided and eventually ends up in captivity to another kingdom. Now, the conventional interpretation of these events, which is actually stated explicitly in the text, is that Israel is punished because it fails to be loyal to God. Its leaders drift off to worshiping other gods. Baal is one of them, B-A-A-L. And the one true God is angry and punishes them. Daniel Berrigan, the writer of that book, Kings and Their Gods, he has a different take. He reads the books of Kings, and draws the conclusion that kings choose convenient gods. In fact, kings, whether they ruled 2,500 years ago or right now, often choose or focus on gods that reflect back to them what they consider to be most important. The kings of ancient Israel had gods that justified their muting the voices of women, that justified enslaving whole groups of people, that justified keeping huge standing armies for maintaining power and wealth. The kings chose convenient gods who look a lot and think a lot like them. And we certainly see plenty of that in our own time. Certainly our recently deposed King Trump worshiped a god of vanity and self-interest that justified interfering with our democracy and self-dealing to enrich himself. But greed and the acquisition of power are certainly gods in the United States. They are certainly a religion that is powerful in the United States. And our larger country relies on slaves and militarism, just like the old kings, to promote the empire as a religion too. You know, if you've watched a sporting event like any time in the last 20 years, you probably saw something happen that seems so normal, you may not even have noticed it or thought it remarkable. So this event happens, this sporting event, it begins with a sort of religious ceremony. A hymn is sung, actually the national anthem. It's sung in the presence of a military honor guard, symbolic priests of a cult of militarism. And on the high holidays, like the Super Bowl, $1 billion worth of fighter jets will fly over, offering the final blessing. It's a religious act. What is it doing there at the beginning of a football game or a baseball game? How did this happen? And while explicit slavery isn't legal here anymore, this country is fine with placing people in a kind of legal slavery. This country worships the religion of capitalism fervently. So people work two jobs and they have no health care, no guarantee of housing, no promise of a secure and comfortable retirement. The religion of capitalism decrees that the market sets wages, and our corporate priest class render us in a legal slavery that I think would make Jeroboam blush. Jeroboam was one of those old kings from Kings 1 and 2. And let's be bipartisan about this. Barack Obama started attending Reverend Jeremiah Wright's church in the 80s when he was an organizer in Chicago. He and Michelle Obama got married there, and their children were baptized in that church and spent many Sundays on their childhood there. But Reverend Wright was and is a fiery minister, and his truth-telling did not play well with those who would continue the status quo of the United States as empire. You may have heard of the sermon Reverend Wright gave after 9/11, when he said that instead of God bless America, we should be saying God damn America. This is really strong stuff, I know. And I also want to acknowledge that Reverend Wright made some anti-Semitic statements, and that is absolutely wrong. But he also spoke about the internment camps and the reservations and the Jim Crow and all the ways that this country has failed to live into its values. And over time, the God that Reverend Wright answered to became inconvenient for the then President Obama. And Obama cut his ties with the church where his family was formed. Kings choose their gods. Reverend Wright brings us to another point that Berrigan makes about kings and their gods. Berrigan points out that the absence of prophets, that's prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, makes it easier for kings to worship immoral gods. It's notable that in the first part of Kings, when Israel is on the ascent, there are no prophets present to protest or to criticize or to offer another path. Fortunately, in our time, we are blessed with many prophets. And this seems like a good time to talk about the prophet Daniel Berrigan, also writer of the book. Daniel Berrigan was a Jesuit priest, and he passed in 2016 at the age of 94. He and his brother Philip, a former priest, were outspoken critics of militarism, starting with the Vietnam War. In 1968, he and a group of activists entered the draft board in Catonsville, Maryland, and they stole draft records and they burnt them using homemade napalm. Berrigan would say at the time that killing others was repugnant to the letter and spirit of the Sermon on the Mount. He took his Christianity seriously. He was a member of the Jesuit order, but he was always an outsider. He ended up going to jail for his moral stance in Catonsville in 1968. And when he got out of prison in 1972, he moved into a Jesuit residence in New York City. I've been to that residence. Then he went on a lecture tour where he did not back down from his beliefs. And when he returned to that Jesuit residence, he found the locks changed and his few possessions in boxes outside the entrance. I want to read you a piece from a review of a biography by Berrigan. The review is written by a man named Patrick Henry, not that Patrick Henry. Here's what it says. They, the Jesuits, almost kicked me into outer darkness after Catonsville, wrote Dan years later to his brother Phil. But I was saved by Provincial Robert Mitchell, that's a church official, who flew to Rome to stop the show. His law-breaking actions also alienated him more generally from both Catholic clergy and laity. The Catholic hierarchy supported the war in Vietnam. Generally speaking, the Catholics were fiercely patriotic. They wanted to prove that there was no contradiction between being Catholic and being American. This emerged grotesquely in Cardinal Francis Spellman's infamous "My Country, Right or Wrong." End of quote. Berrigan did not care about being an outsider. In fact, he's notorious for saying, a good way to build a peace movement is to start small and get smaller. So after the Vietnam War, Berrigan worked for nuclear disarmament. In his mind, this marked a passage from civil disobedience to divine obedience. Moving from civil disobedience to divine obedience. And this is a divine obedience expressed in Isaiah 2:4, chapter 2, verse 4. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. And plowshares became the name of the movement that Berrigan was part of. On September 9th, 1980, the first plowshares action took place. The plowshares group could not live with the possibility of nuclear war and felt that even to hold nuclear weapons was a sin. So the Plowshares 8, which included Dan and his brother Phil, entered the General Electric facility in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and using hammers, they damaged two nuclear warhead cones of Mark 12A missiles, and they poured their own blood onto top secret blueprints. Berrigan had a flair for the dramatic, but more importantly, he was not afraid to be accountable for his actions. When they did those two acts of civil disobedience that I just described, the Maryland Draft Board and then the nuclear disobedience, the group didn't run away afterwards. They stayed put so that they could be arrested and use their time in court to make their moral arguments publicly. Over time, Berrigan was recognized as the prophet that he truly was, and his beliefs moved from the fringes towards the center. Not completely to the center, however. It's worth noting that the U.S. College of Catholic Cardinals unanimously voted to support the war in Afghanistan. The work of a prophet is slow. But it's easy to see the prophets all around us these days. I mean, what a blessing. And I think there are prophets in this congregation working quietly from their convictions to make a more just and caring world. Everyone here can be a prophet. We just need to consider our theologies. And here's how I think about theology or a set of beliefs when I'm trying to decide if an idea is right for me. I ask myself, is this theology life expanding or life limiting? Life expanding or life limiting? You know, there's a local minister who's a leader of a large church who goes on Twitter to rail against the shutdowns that the governor has imposed to curb the pandemic and save lives. And I see his posts and I am like, what theology is this guy operating from? How does he justify holding live worship right now? You know, like I say, I don't understand his theology, but I do have to say, I'm sure of this. It's not life expanding. It's not life expanding. Anyways, that criteria of life expanding versus life limiting can help us create moral imperatives. When we see situations that are life limiting, we can understand that we are called to action and we can respond with life expanding theologies, life expanding practices. This way of looking at things can help us become prophets, each in our own way. So I'm hoping that hearing about these kings from 2,500 years ago is a bit of a comfort. It tells us that this kind of behavior from our leaders has been around for a long, long time. Long enough to bring us to ask if this is not just part of the human condition. Maybe that's a small comfort, or maybe it's no comfort at all. I do want to say, I know how weary we all are right now. I know we all have some despair. You know, in the reading that we had, Thomas Merton wrote, we should all be sick in some way. We should all feel near to despair in some sense, because this semi-despair is the normal form taken by hope in a time like ours. The despair we feel is hard to bear, especially in this exhausted marathon of surviving the election, surviving the pandemic. But the despair we feel also shows us that we are not numb to the suffering of others. It shows us that our humanity is still intact. Despite everything we've been through, our humanity is still intact. And there is a dignity and wisdom in that. Kings will choose their gods, and there's only so much we can do about it. But our bearing witness and hurting along with the most vulnerability, that has nobility and grace in it. In that compassion that we feel lies the seeds for us to become prophets. May it be so, and blessed be.
That's a tough act to follow, Bob. Let's take a moment now for our attention to generosity. Our change for the future recipient this quarter is SAGE. SAGE provides support for older LGBT people in the Albuquerque metropolitan area through advocacy, social programs, education, support groups, and resource distribution. They counter isolation, fear, and loneliness by creating a caring community of LGBT elders who will look out for each other. You can make an offering online by clicking on the link that we'll put in the chat box. And if you prefer not to give online, you can always simply mail a check to the church. Recently, we asked folks during worship to share one word for the coming year. Our tech arts director, Chris Paul, has formed these into a dove meditation that we will now be sharing during our offertory and for the rest of the holiday season. Let us now exercise the enduring power of generosity.
What is generously given is received with gratitude. Thank you on behalf of the congregation and on behalf of SAGE. We're coming to the end of this morning's formal service, and as always, you are invited to stay for small breakout groups and chat with a small group of folks. If you'd like to do that, just stay on through the postlude, and those breakout rooms will open up and you'll automatically be put in one of those. And whether your conversations continue in breakout rooms or in the rooms of your home or outdoors on a walk, you might like a discussion prompt to get things going. So here's a suggestion. Reverend Bob talked about life-expanding beliefs and life-limiting beliefs. Which beliefs do you personally experience as life-expanding? Which ones do you fully embrace? Which ones would you like to embrace, but maybe you're grappling with them in some way? Which beliefs do you find life-expanding? Which ones do you fully embrace? Which ones are you still grappling with? And now Bob will lead us in extinguishing the chalice.
Let's extinguish our chalices. When joy sneaks in and surprises us with grace, may we stop for just one sacred moment and celebrate. Our worship has ended. Our service begins. Go in peace, gentle people, and practice radical love.